The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
At just 16 years old, Rod Farrell stepped out of the darkness of Murray, Kentucky, captured by sinister illusions that propelled him to the forefront of a cult centered around ritualistic practices. In the once tranquil setting of a home, he masterminded the savage crime of taking out a 14-year-old cult member's parents, an act that cemented his notorious legacy. Cloaked in enigma and terror, his deeds made him the youngest person to ever face death row, a destiny that hung heavily over him until it was eventually altered to lifetime imprisonment with no chance of release. This is the untold story of the Kentucky Vampire Clan.
Hey everyone, as many of you know, I finally took the leap of faith and I'm now making content full-time to support my family. This is truly a dream come true, but I need your support now more than ever. So I'm asking, if you want to enjoy my content ad-free and enable me to do more stuff for you guys, please check out my Patreon and YouTube membership programs. And thank you for watching Mystery Archives.
Roderick Justin Farrell was born into a young family in Murray, Kentucky, in March of 1980. His teenage parents soon parted ways when his father enlisted in the military, leaving him in the care of his mother, Sandra Gibson. Their living situation fluctuated, sometimes residing with his grandparents. Court documents reveal Farrell's allegations of being abused by his maternal grandfather at age 5, though these claims never led to any criminal charges. The mother and son duo also faced times of instability, relying on public housing and Sandra's income from exotic dancing and occasional sex work. Roderick's childhood was marked by these hardships and the absence of a father figure, compounded by serious yet unproven accusations of abuse by his grandfather, added layers of complexity and unanswered questions to his early years. The domestic life of Sandra and Rod was marked by instability, constantly shifting between temporary stays at Sandra's parents' abode and an assortment of public housing accommodations. From the earliest moments of Rod's childhood, Sandra initiated him into the shadowy world of the undead, nurturing a mutual obsession with the lore of vampires through the medium of Dracula films and the pages of Vampire: The Masquerade novels. Yet this connection they shared was overshadowed by Sandra's questionable parenting methods and what Rod ambiguously described as the complex essence of their relationship. Gibson permitted Farrell to construct an altar dedicated to satanic worship, adorned with an inverted cross and skulls within his bedroom. In her own bedroom, she displayed a satanic emblem prominently on the floor. Furthermore, she allowed Farrell to skip school and neglected to seek psychological assistance for him when he began engaging in self-harm. Gibson engaged inappropriately with her son's friends, earning probation for her attempts to seduce a 14-year-old into a physical encounter under the guise of a vampire initiation ritual. Additionally, she harbored romantic feelings for Stephen Murphy, a teenager she believed had transformed Farrell into a vampire. Murphy testified before the jury, revealing that he had initiated Farrell into vampirism through a ritual in a graveyard 2 years prior. involving the cutting of their arms and the mutual consumption of each other's blood. This ritual was not a one-time event. Rather, it became a regular practice for them. Additionally, they often participated in nighttime gatherings dedicated to occult role-playing, immersing themselves in these activities until the early hours. As Sandra reached the age of 34, the already strained dynamics with her son took a darker turn. This was brought to light when she found to be exchanging unsettlingly affectionate love letters with the 14-year-old boy. These letters were not merely inappropriate. They were a window into the depth of dysfunction and the twisted intertwining of love and darkness that defined their household, adding layers of mystery and concern to an already complicated family dynamic. After Sandra's parents settled into a new home they acquired in Eustis, Florida, around the year 1990, Gibson and Farrell found themselves oscillating between Murray and Eustis. It was during their time in Florida that Farrell struck up a friendship with Heather Windorf, a sophomore at Eustis High School. Described by the Sentinel as a rebellious teen who clashed with her parents over mundane tasks such as cleaning her room, Heather's relationship with her family was fraught. Following Farrell's return to Kentucky for his 10th grade year, he maintained contact with Heather through collect calls, incurring significant phone bills that eventually led her parents to intervene, a decision that left Heather fuming. Upon returning to the familiar environment of Murray, Farrell began weaving intricate narratives about his alleged identity as a 500-year-old vampire, adopting the moniker Visaggio. This persona became the cornerstone of his enigmatic allure, attracting a dedicated circle of followers, each drawn to his dark charisma and the promise of belonging to something beyond the ordinary. Among these adherents was Howard Scott Anderson, a 16-year-old who grappled with the hardships of a tumultuous upbringing, characterized by financial instability and the shadow of domestic turmoil cast by an alcoholic father known for his abusive behavior towards Anderson's mother. The cadre of followers that Farrell amassed was as diverse as it was devoted. There was Charity Kesey, a young woman whose search for acceptance and understanding led her into Farrell's orbit, her own life marked by a series of personal challenges that rendered her susceptible to the allure of Farrell's world. Dana Cooper, another key figure in the group, found in Farrell's tales of vampirism an eternal life of refuge from her own demons and the alienation she felt from society at large. As Farrell's influence grew, so too did the escalation of their activities. October of 1996 marked a turning point when Farrell and his followers were implicated in a particularly disturbing episode at the Murray Calloway County Animal Shelter. In an event that shook the local community, two puppies were found dead under gruesome circumstances, a chilling testament to the increasing malevolence of the group's actions. The incident was a stark departure from the group's previously less ominous endeavors and heralded a descent into more sinister behavior. The book The Vampire Killers provides a detailed account of the aftermath of this incident, chronicling Farrell's arrest and the charges levied against him, including burglary, trespassing, and the egregious act of cruelty to animals. This escalation not only marked a dark chapter in the group's history, but also served as a prelude to more heinous acts that would later define their legacy. Each follower bound by their own complex tapestry of personal strife and the draw of Farrell's vampiric fantasy found themselves embroiled in a narrative that would ultimately lead them far from the paths they may have taken otherwise, plunging them into an abyss from which there would be no return. The congregation's sanctuary was ominously dubbed the Vampire Hotel, a forsaken edifice veiled by the dense woods encircling Kentucky Lake, nestled in the secluded expanse of the land between the lakes. This sinister venue, shrouded in mystery and decay, served as the clandestine gathering point for the Klan. Within its crumbling walls, they indulged in hedonistic revelries, immersed themselves in the mind-altering haze of psychedelic substances, and engaged in arcane rituals that whispered of ancient, forgotten rites. According to Rod, the very atmosphere of the place hummed with an eerie energy, as if the land itself bore witness to the dark ceremonies that unfolded under the cloak of night, adding yet more layers of mystery and foreboding to their nocturnal assemblies. In the shadowed chill of November of 1996, a moment pregnant with dark potentialities unfolded as Rod Farrell, alongside with youthful accomplice and lover Charity Kesey, Howard Scott Anderson, and Dana Cooper, who was then 19, set forth on an unholy expedition. They traversed the roads in Anderson's vehicle, cutting through the veils of the night towards Eustace. Their mission was to retrieve Heather Windorf. Farrell, ensnared by visions of a grandiose future, dreamt of leading them to New Orleans. There, amidst the city's cryptic aura, they aspired to rebirth themselves into a vampiric dynasty, shrouded from the eyes of the world. Within Farrell's twisted salvation narrative, he cast himself as the savior, pulling Windorf from the tempest of her familiar strife. Documents from the court peeled back the layers of this saga, revealing Heather's whispered admissions to Farrell. She spoke of shadows cast by alleged abuse from her parents, and of a deep-seated desperation to flee the confines of her oppressive home life. This intricate lattice of connections, ambitions dark as the void, and secretive plans laid the groundwork for a sequence of events destined to unravel with harrowing consequences, all enshrouded within an impenetrable cloak of ominous anticipation. On the chilly evening of November 25th, 1996, Rod Farrell and his entourage embarked on a lengthy 750-mile journey from the quaint town of Murray, Kentucky, to the sun-drenched streets of Eustis, Florida. Their mission was fraught with anticipation and dark purpose. Upon successfully retrieving Heather after their vehicle succumbed to mechanical failure, a secretive pact was forged between her and Rod. Heather agreed to give Rod the keys to her family's home, thereby enabling the theft of the family's vehicle to ensure the group's passage to New Orleans could proceed. In a twisted exchange for her complicity, Rod vowed to initiate Heather into their vampiric fold through a macabre turning ritual, promising her an eternal existence alongside him. The ceremony took place in a secluded area of a Eustis cemetery just before dawn. To prepare, Rod took a significant amount of LSD, which altered his perception and made the atmosphere of the ritual seem more intense. Heather, following through on her agreement and wanting to change, drank blood from a cut that Roderick had made on himself with a razor blade. This action showed her commitment to their agreement and represented her step into the lifestyle that Farrell had described to her. With the ritual concluding and their pact sealed in blood, the group hastily departed the cemetery. Their immediate objective was to return to Heather's residence to procure the family car, a crucial element in their grand plan to reach New Orleans. Upon their stealthy entrance into the Wendorf home, through the dimly lit garage, Roderick and Scott encountered Mr. Richard Wendorf, 49 years old, in the throes of a peaceful slumber on the living room couch. The boys maneuvered past him, his presence undisturbed by their silent footsteps. A cursory sweep of the house was all it took before their paths led them back to the unsuspecting figure on the sofa. Roderick later confessed that that night was never meant to end in bloodshed. Yet as he stood over Richard once more, something dark and uncontrollable within him was unleashed. A silent exchange of glances between Rod and Anderson served as the prelude to the chaos that was about to unfold. Anderson would later recall the moment with chilling simplicity, stating, "That's when Rod went crazy." With a frenzied energy, Farrell raised a crowbar high, bringing it down on Richard's skull with terrifying force. Not once, but repeatedly. The violence of the assault was such that blood was cast in a horrific arc, marking every surface of the living room and a grim testament to the brutality of the act. The ferocity of the blows was enough to dislodge teeth from Richard's mouth, scattering them amidst the spattered blood, where they would later be painstakingly collected by investigators as silent witnesses to the barbarity of that night. Ruth Wendorf, aged 54, and a committed volunteer at the Eustis High School, was oblivious to the grim scene unfolding in her living room as she showered while her husband met a brutal end. When she emerged from the bathroom, clad in her robe and entirely unaware of the tragedy, she proceeded into the kitchen. It was there that she encountered Rod Farrell, chillingly holding a crowbar dripping with her husband's blood. Rod reportedly confessed to her that he had just ended her husband's life. Shocked, and undoubtedly grappling with the sudden horror of the situation, Mrs. Wendorf inquired about his intentions. In response, Farrell advanced towards her, prompting her to defensively throw the contents of her coffee cup at him. The hot liquid only seemed to fuel Rod's rage, leading to his violent outburst. The aftermath of their confrontation told a tale of desperate struggle. An examination of her body revealed numerous defensive wounds across her hands and arms, testifying to the fierce resistance she mounted. Rod, too, would bear evidence of the altercation, with numerous scratches adorning the right side of his face and neck, markers of Ruth's valiant fight. In a frantic bid to escape, Ruth attempted to flee through the kitchen. However, Farrell was alarmingly close and managed to deliver 4 devastating blows to the back of her skull, with such force that fragments of her shattered skull were subsequently discovered in the dining room. This act of brutality marked the tragic culmination of the encounter, leaving a stark and harrowing scene in its wake. By that time, you know, it was pretty obvious. I had blood on me and a crowbar in my hand. I was fixing to say, "Yeah, I want to have coffee with you, son of a bitching smartass." But anyway, that's when she lunged at me, because I was actually going to let her live. But after she lunged at me, I just took the bottom of the crowbar and kept stabbing it through her skull. Whenever she fell down, I just continually beat her until I saw her brains falling on the floor, because that pissed me off. And that was pulled from Roderick Farrell's confession regarding the unaliving of Ruth Wendorf. According to the detailed account provided by Rod Farrell, Scott Anderson refrained from physically assaulting either of the victims during the tragic events that unfolded. However, Anderson's inaction extended further as he failed to offer any form of assistance or intervention to the victims. In the grim aftermath, both he and Rod embarked on a meticulous search throughout the house, their objective clear: to locate the keys to the Wendorf's Ford Explorer. Their search wasn't solely for the vehicle's keys. They also scavenged for any cash laying around, no matter how insignificant the amount, adding theft to their already heinous acts. Rod's recounting of his emotional state following the brutal murders is chillingly detailed. He describes an overwhelming sense and euphoria, a disturbing euphoria that coursed through him, likening his feelings to those of a deity wielding the ultimate dominion over life and death itself. This disturbing admission reveals a profound detachment from the gravity of his actions, illustrating a deeply troubling mindset. The macabre scene took an even darker turn before their departure from the Wendorf residence. Rod engaged in what can only be described as a grotesque, ritualistic display around Richard Wendorf's lifeless body, which was slowly losing its warmth. This ghastly dance was not merely an act of disrespect, but seemed to serve as a sinister celebration of the violence he had inflicted. Following this eerie display, Rod proceeded to desecrate the body further. He forcibly opened the shirt of the deceased and, with a lit cigarette, meticulously burned the letter V into Richard Wendorf's chest. This act was not random vandalism, but a calculated symbol, the signature of Visaggio, the vampiric persona that Rod had adopted. This act of branding the victim post-mortem served as a twisted claim of responsibility and a stark manifestation of Rod's delusions and the depth of his immersion in a dark, fantastical identity. Jennifer Wendorf, age 17, Heather's sister, was elsewhere, engaged in her job, while the grim fate of her parents was being sealed by Rod. Lately, tensions had flared between her and her parents, primarily due to Jennifer's recurrent breaches of the curfew to spend time with her boyfriend. That night, upon returning home a tad later than expected, Jennifer was intent on avoiding any confrontation. She aimed to move as stealthily as possible, hoping to slip unnoticed into her bedroom, thereby dodging any potential scolding of her tardiness. As she entered, Jennifer noticed the outline of her father in the dim light, seemingly at rest. Believing him to be asleep, she proceeded with the utmost silence towards the kitchen. It was there that she stumbled upon a harrowing sight: her mother's lifeless body, sprawled between the kitchen and the dining room, her face downturned, immersed in a chilling pool of blood. Overwhelmed by confusion and terror, Jennifer hastily reached for the phone to dial 911. With her voice shaking, she attempted to articulate the horror she had just discovered, struggling to convey the gravity of the situation through her frantic explanations. Rod Farrell and his followers fled, leaving the town of Eustace behind as they ventured into the unknown, aiming for a fresh start in Louisiana. Debate continues to swirl around the extent of Heather's awareness prior to the tragic events. However, it was unmistakably clear to her when Rod arrived to pick her up and the other girls in the stolen Explorer, his appearance marred by blood. At that moment, any doubts she might have had evaporated. There's consensus among those involved that Heather was unaware of Rod's hideous intentions. Rod himself has claimed that there was never a concrete plan to commit the unthinkable, although this claim is somewhat contradicted by other statements, indicating that there had been discussions about potentially killing the Wendorfs during their journey to Florida, a notion they all purportedly considered a dark jest. Rod also maintained that Dana and Charity were merely facilitators who dropped him off at the scene, unaware of the impending horror. This, he asserts, remains an ambiguous part of the narrative. Moreover, Rod suggested that Heather was not entirely in the dark about the potential for violence. He recounted numerous discussions with her and her alleged home abuse, which, for clarification, Heather did not experience. According to Rod, Heather was well aware of the looming threat of her parents' lives, a claim that has not wavered over time. From my perspective, it's plausible that Heather was more knowledgeable about the situation than she's admitted. In a separate development, an abandoned Buick was discovered by a deputy sheriff in Seminole County, left in Sanford, near the Central Florida Zoo, off U.S. Highway 1792. The car's license plate was registered to the Wendorf's Explorer. A BOL logo goes out for the stolen vehicle, a blue Explorer bearing Kentucky tag DTB-836. After 3 days of travel, Rod Farrell's group found themselves in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, exhausted, famished, and penniless. Aimlessly, they roamed the city streets, devoid of any clear direction or purpose. In a moment of desperation, Charity Kesey reached out to her grandmother in South Dakota, hopeful for financial assistance. Unbeknownst to Kesey, her grandmother alerted the authorities to their location, persuading her granddaughter and the rest of the group to seek refuge at a nearby Howard Johnson's hotel. She unknowingly lured them into a meticulously laid trap. Consequently, the Kentucky vampire cult, oblivious to the impending law enforcement ambush, walked directly into custody. Without resistance, they were detained in a Baton Rouge jail, where they awaited extradition to Florida for a week. In the confines of the Lake County Detention Center, Rod Farrell's confession unfolded with a chilling lack of regret. He appeared to take a perverse pride in his actions, meticulously recounting the grisly specifics of his crimes with a morbid enthusiasm that painted a vivid and horrifying picture. In front of the cameras, Rod turned his court appearances into a spectacle, smirking and delivering caustic remarks with a defiant air. Sandra, his mother, swiftly took to the media to defend him. Her expressions of support for vampirism and Rod's chosen way of life provided a revealing look into the unusual and unsettling environment that shaped his childhood and adolescence. Following their arrest, Farrell fully embraced the persona of a vampire antagonist. In discussions with the Orlando Sentinel, he made the astonishing claim that he was the victim of a setup by a rival vampire faction, contending he had multiple personalities and was attempting to abandon his vampire identity. His defiance was on full display during photo sessions, where he would provocatively stick out his tongue or sarcastically utter, "God bless America." Contrary to his previous defiant stance, Farrell surprised everyone by pleading guilty to the two counts of first degree at the commencement of his trial on February the 5th, 1998. He acknowledges his responsibility and desires to continue living, his lawyer stated. moving his mother to tears. Shortly thereafter, he was sentenced to death, with CBS News quoting Circuit Judge Jerry Lockett as saying, "I perceive you as a disturbed young man. Your family let you down, as did society." Howard Scott Anderson, for his involvement in the Windorf slayings, entered a guilty plea in April of 1998 and was sentenced to life imprisonment. Soon after, Dana Cooper and Charity Kesey reached plea agreements, resulting in reduced charges and sentences. Kesey received a 10-year sentence, while Cooper was sentenced to 17 years. Both women have since been released. In December of 2018, the Daily Commercial reported that Anderson's sentence was reduced to 40 years, with credit for time served. He is expected to be released at the age of 51. Rod Farrell is currently incarcerated at the Tomoka Correctional Institution, located in Volusia County, Florida. At the tender age of 17, Farrell became the youngest inmate on death row in the United States. His death sentence was converted to life imprisonment in November of 2000, following a Florida Supreme Court decision that mandated that perpetrators be at least 17 years old at the time of their crime to be eligible for capital punishment. In an attempt to reduce his life sentence, Farrell approached the courts once more in 2020, only to be met with a denial. The presiding judge described him as irreparably corrupt in his ruling. During the 2020 sentencing hearing, Jennifer Windorf, Heather Windorf's sister, provided a powerful testimony. She recounted the profound trauma she continues to endure as the one who discovered the bodies of her parents. Her pleas to the judge were not ignored. She would say, "May I have a place that's not traumatized by looking over my shoulder? If he ever gets out, I'll be destroyed. I'll be back to that lonely little girl nearly 23 years ago." This story is not only a disturbing look into the depths of what the human being is capable of doing and imagining, but also the psychology of a cult. The want to be a part of something bigger than yourself. The longing for purpose. The willingness to do whatever you are told. And although brutal, I do think this story was both captivating as well as incredibly sorrowful. I hope it can serve as a testament to cults and their potential to harm people in and out of them. And may we all learn these lessons the easy way, rather than the hard way. For now, all I can do is wish Jennifer Windorf and all of the families of those involved peace, and that eventually their scars of the trauma perpetrated by the Kentucky Vampire Clan will eventually heal, but only time will tell. Thank you all so much for watching this new episode. I love learning about and covering cults and crimes on occasion. I thought this would be a cool way to intertwine both while I work on a longer paranormal episode for you guys. If you like this video, please give it a like, subscribe with notifications, and leave me a comment letting me know your thoughts below. Don't forget to check out today's sponsor, and I will see you guys very soon with yet another new video. Until next time, this has been Cody here at Mystery Archives. Remember to stay safe out there, and take care.